My name is Andy, and I am an alcoholic.
I was beginning to think you guys were a little subdued over here in your home turf. So we do it a little different from where I've come from. My home group is the world-famous Monday Night Speakers Meeting in the Sobriety Capital World, St. Petersburg, Florida. My sobriety date is August 7th, 1994, and yes, I am one of those old guys that goes to bed at 8 o'clock at night. If I stay up till 9, I turn into a pumpkin. Little green things start to grow out of the top of my head. You know, when I first came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 23 years old. And I looked around, and I did not see anybody that looked like you guys. I saw a bunch of people that looked like me, which I thought was really old at the time. And, you know, one of the things that I really struggled with for a long time until I got sober was I'm too young to be an alcoholic. This doesn't mesh with my plan. Never during my childhood do I remember waking up thinking, golly, yeah, I want to be an alcoholic someday. You know, that is in my goal list, is to be an alcoholic. Although I had the behaviors from a very early age, you know, I remember play drinking with one of my friends over at the house where I'd gotten a rocks glass, put ice in it and water and yellow food coloring him, and convinced him it was scotch. What am I, 8 years old or something like that? Obviously, I've got the behaviors. But, you know, when I came here, it just didn't work. I mean, it didn't jive with the logic that I had in my head of what an alcoholic was, because I'd seen alcoholism. You know, I was telling John on the way over here, I used to work in hospitals and spent a lot of time working on orthopedic floors, and invariably on an orthopedic floor is typically where you're going to find a wet drunk that goes into DTs at 11:15 in the evening when you get off at 11:30. And, you know, I watched a lot of it. I mean, I can't remember how many times that I saw that while I was working in the hospital, but it didn't register. You know, at the time I was drinking, but my drinking hadn't gotten out of control. It hadn't caused me any problems, per se. Although the first time I picked up a drink, I got drunk, and I passed out, and I did stupid things, and I woke up the next morning with a nightmarish hangover. But I do remember saying, I want to do this again. Because like you hear a lot of times from the podium and you hear people talk, I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. You know, I was the round peg being tried to be jammed into the square hole. You know, I literally was the nerd in school. You know, when it was cool to wear wire frames and have long hair, I had black frames and short hair. Now it seems to be like the end thing, and I was going back to the long hair for not too long ago, and somebody, you know, badmouthed me into getting a haircut. So it's very common for us, and especially for alcoholics, to not fit in or feel like we fit in. Continually comparing my insides to everybody else's outsides and judging myself based on that, which is very little knowledge. You know, I've learned as I've spent some time in the program and really drilled down into the steps and tried to get a better understanding of how I can grow in my sobriety. I realize that we all come from the center of our own universe. You know, don't we? The world does revolve around me. It doesn't revolve around you. It revolves around me. Because this is my perspective, not looking from your eyes or anybody else's eyes that I come across during daily life. Now, I actually think that's probably a human condition and not necessarily something that is unique to alcoholics. But the one thing that it is for me is that if I continue to live in the center of my own sobriety, it can become fatal. Because if I live in the center, not in the center of my own sobriety, the center of my own universe. If I live in the center of my own universe and I don't get out and I don't see things from other people's perspective and try and walk in other people's footsteps and continue to take personal inventory and continue to work on my character defects. I'm destined to return to whence I came. You know, I'm coming up, God willing, the creek don't rise. I don't decide to go out and experiment again. I'll be coming up on 16 years of sobriety on August 7th. And that's really kind of amazing. Now, if you think about it, the math of when I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and today don't match with 16 years of sobriety. Just back up a little bit here. I was born and raised in Northern California in Eureka. I'm sure that some people have heard of the Emerald Triangle and Humboldt Homegrown. That's where I grew up. That was my life. And my parents were just normal people. You know, I used to think at one point in my sobriety that it was definitely my parents and my family that had created my alcoholism. And I was reading a book called Toxic Parents. I am one today. I was reading a book called Toxic Parents, and my folks actually happened to be visiting, and the book was in the master bathroom, sitting on the back of the toilet seat. My father had gone in there, and he came back, and he said, "Am I a toxic parent?" You know, it kind of set me back on my heels. Because no, he was not a toxic parent. Neither was my mother, even though she was nuts. She was not a toxic parent, you know. And there had been no more dysfunction in my family, in my life, than a lot of other people that had not grown up to be alcoholics. I began to understand that my parents had done the best that they could with what they had. And the cards had been dealt in my life, and it was my choice to pick them up and play them or not. And it was my responsibility for what happens in my life today. And if I look back and I'm trying to blame anyone for anything, my alcoholism, my actions, the outcome of my actions, then I'm not living a sober life. And I'm looking for an easier, softer way. You know, I was cleaning out my desk the other day. I had to move offices. And I came across a note that I used to have taped to, a sticky note taped to my computer. And it had fallen off, gotten in a desk drawer or something like that. And it said, excellence. No, it says, hang on a second. Let me just look at this because I wrote it down again. Yeah, I am getting old. Don't forget that. Easy is seldom excellent. And excellence is seldom easy. You know, and it talks about in our text about we always look for an easier, softer way. And I always look for an easier, softer way. My friends used to talk, you know, look at me. I gained the name of Houdini because whenever I seemed to get myself in a jam, either with drinking or, you know, catting around, doing whatever it was, I could somehow get myself out of one of those impossible jams and right the ship, so to speak, and things would be okay for a little while. And so they thought that I was like Houdini, that I could get out of anything. If you think about, I grew up in Northern California and I've lived all across the country. One time I actually sat down and counted all the different residences that I'd had and it'd been, it was 40-something. It was crazy. And the number of jobs that I had before I got sober was well close to 100. Geographical cures in a new job and a different set of circumstances was definitely one of the cures that I attempted to use during my life to, if things got too hot, that I'd run away. I started drinking in earnest after I got out of high school. I went to a private Christian boarding academy in Oregon, and during that time in my life, I remember that things were pretty good. You know, things were pretty even keel in my life. And if I look back at it now, I understand that I was living a spiritual life. My alcoholism was not necessarily growing in my life. I was actually living a spiritual life. When I got out of school and I went to college and actually had come home from that school, I disconnected from all my friends, and I disconnected from the church, and I disconnected from that whole lifestyle. And that hole in my heart began to open up again, and I began to compare my insides with everybody's outsides, and I got very self-centered. And it became very easy for me to start picking up a drink. One thing led to another, and I've lived in San Francisco, and I've lived in Los Angeles, and I've lived in New England, and all over the place. But 90% of those travels have all been due to alcohol or other chemical substance. I do understand the singleness of purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I do really think that drugs brought the bottom up for me, made the fuse burn faster, because I don't think that I would have ended up in the hospital with a drug and alcohol overdose in the intensive care unit with cardiac, almost cardiac failure, if it hadn't been for the mixture of other substances. And when presented with this, this was the first time that it had been presented to me from the outside that I had a problem. I really tried to weasel around and try and figure things out. After I got out of the hospital, I went to the cardiologist, and my girlfriend and my mom were there, I didn't want him to go into the doctor's office with me because I didn't want to hear him say, "Now remember, you can't drink." So when I came out and got in the car and we were ready to take off, "Well, what did they say about your drinking?" He said, "Well, I can have a couple of beers every once in a while." Now when you think about it, logically, what's wrong with a couple of beers? For anybody that's normal and doesn't have alcoholism. So I continued to fight back and forth of drinking. But it had become apparent to other people in my life that I had a drinking problem, or at least it had become apparent to them, and it was now apparent to me that it was apparent to them. So I began to have to start hiding it. And that's when the chaos really kicked in. And I'm sure we've all played the games of, "No, I haven't been drinking." Well, have you ever smelled somebody that's been drinking when you haven't been drinking? Phew. So, I can just imagine what those lies looked like from the outside. And it was strongly suggested to me after a period of time that I go to treatment. And this suggestion actually came from my boss at work. He called me in the office and he said, "Andy, when we hired you, you were the best employee we had. And now I'm trying to make up excuses not to fire you. Do you think you might be drinking too much?" And I started off with the excuses of, my wife and my kid and da-da-da and all this other stuff and everything. One of my favorite sayings used to be that I'm powerless over alcohol and my wife is unmanageable. And he said, "Well, are you willing to at least go talk to somebody about this?" And in the back of my mind, I knew that things weren't right because I had drunk dialed friends, in the middle of the night. You remember those, right? Or you don't remember those. And told them, "I think I'm an alcoholic. I think I've got problems with alcohol and drugs and da-da-da-da-da." And then, of course, a couple of days later, they're going, "That conversation we had on the phone the other night, are you going to do something about it? What are you talking about? Are you crazy? Were you drunk?" So in my own soul, I had an idea that this just wasn't right. So I've considered myself to be a relatively honest person up to this point. But when I look back at it, I was anything but. But considering myself an honest person, I went into this alcoholic counselor, and we sat down and we took the 12 testing question test, of answer these questions honestly to see if you've got a problem with alcohol. And I answered them honestly because I really wanted to answer. And then somewhere down deep in my heart, I wanted to know the truth. And I really hoped it was true that no, I didn't have a problem with alcohol. And I passed with a 100% score of yes, you're an alcoholic. And she said, "Do you need help?" Now, nobody had ever said anything to me about "do you need help" before, but I thought back, no, I don't need help. I'm Houdini, remember? And the other thing was is that I thought that I could, just through magic of time travel, or some other crazy idea, revert back to the time when I was in high school living a spiritual life, and everything would be okay, and this problem with alcohol would disappear. And didn't work that way. At that point, I stopped being a daily drinker because it was just too difficult to hide it and to manage daily life. And at the time, I took out what I like to call my very cheap Walmart brand trash bag. It was not a Hefty. And I put it over my shoulder, and I began to stuff life in that plastic trash bag. All the resentments that I could pop up just like that. And when that trash bag would get to the point where it would burst, I'd go on a run. And it always seemed, even when I wasn't hiding it, that if I got drunk, I got happy feet. There was a road trip somewhere. You know, I woke up in South Lake Tahoe one time. There was snow on the ground. I live in San Francisco. There's no snow on the ground. I pull into a gas station and ask the guy, where am I? Well, you're at the corner of such and such. No, you don't understand. What town am I in? So, by this time, and I've got some relationship history here, too. I mean, I've used just about everything that you can think of to try and change how I feel. So, I'm 23 years old. I'm married for the second time. I have a daughter. And I disappear for days at a time. You know, and I used to hear stories about these guys talking about, oh, yeah, I went to the corner store for two packs of cigarettes and a loaf of bread, and I came back a week later. And I thought that was a crock, you know. And then when I got to thinking about it, that's exactly what would happen. If I got a chance to get out of the house, my subconscious was going to look for a chance to run. You know? I was telling John that, you know, that particular wife and I didn't see eye to eye, and it didn't work out. And you know, a good portion of that, probably the majority of it, 90%, was my fault. Because I talked about, you know, that she kept a very tight leash on me even after I got sober. Well, I wasn't trustworthy, so why would she not try and keep a tight leash on me? But yeah, I went to the grocery store one time to get milk and lived in a small town. By this time, I'm in Vermont. Lived in a small town, went to the corner store. Somebody said, hey, let's go smoke a joint. And I came back 4 days later. That was a pretty common occurrence. So it was suggested that I probably ought to go to treatment. So I went to treatment, and it was a two-week inpatient treatment center, and I don't remember a damn thing about it except smoking a lot of cigarettes, drinking a lot of coffee. I know we went to alcoholics meeting, AA meetings, but I don't remember them. And I remember this old dude. He was 40. But he looked 80. And he had the alcoholic shuffle. And he was stooped over. And I remember listening to him talk, and he goes, I don't have a problem with alcohol. And then they had the family group. We're all sitting in the family group, and his wife actually told the truth about catching him in the garage drinking cologne. That's all I remember about my first treatment center. So when I got back out of that treatment center, I continued on with the same path of, it didn't take much for that plastic trash bag on my back to explode and for me to go out looking for a way to pick up a drink. The minute I put down a drink, well, I wouldn't say a minute I put down a drink, because usually when I came crawling back into the house, I was thoroughly humiliated beyond belief. And honestly believe when I told my wife, I promise this will never happen again. I thought that was the truth, because I really didn't want this to happen anymore. Shortly after that period, when the heat had blown over and I'd pulled my Houdini trick and things like that, I'd begin to immediately, subconsciously or consciously, start planning the next drink. So I had become pretty successful at putting together 90 days or 6 months of dry time. You know, I went to a few AA meetings, but I remember one time sitting in a big noontime meeting and talking about that I had had a slip. And this old-timer came out of his chair, and he came at me, and he said, what did you do, step on a banana peel? And I thought, you don't get it. My terminal uniqueness kicked back in again, and I was out the door. Because I there were a few young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I sure don't remember any. So I could put together a certain amount of dry time, and then I'd be off on a run somewhere. I had a pretty good knack for making money. I had a pretty good knack for being successful when I wasn't drinking. You know, when I put my mind to doing different things. And I had started a small landscape business out of the trunk of a Trans Am. Think about it, a lawnmower, a weed eater, and a blower sticking out the trunk of a black Trans Am. I was Smokey and the Bandit. And I had built that up to three trucks and trailers and three crews and several hundred accounts. And, you know, I was doing good. I was really doing pretty good. And the trash bag was pretty doggone full. And I used to take my guys that worked with me home and drop them off at the end of the day. And they'd always want to stop at this little country store. And they'd always each get a six-pack. And, Andy, you want a beer? No, get me a Coke. Get me, you know, whatever and stuff like that. But every day, they would ask me if I wanted a beer, if I wanted a six-pack. And I'd say no. Well, this one particular day, I had a flat tire. I broke a shoelace. And one of the lawnmower blades came off of my lawn blower and tore a hole right inside of the lawnmower. Logical reason to get drunk, right? Right? It makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Okay. When they said, do you want a six-pack? I said, yeah, why don't you get me a six-pack? It's been a while. And we went down to the river and we drank that six-pack. And I went back to that store and got a six-pack of non-alcoholic beer so that I could have a reason to walk back in the house with some odor of beer on my breath. It didn't work. And the next day, when I dropped those guys off, they said, do you want a six-pack? I said, yeah. And we went down to the river to drink that six-pack. Now, when I woke up several days later, I looked over in the bed, and I did not recognize the woman that was laying next to me. I was married to a little short Italian with jet black hair, and this woman was tall and blonde. That was my first clue that there was something very wrong here. Had no idea who she was. Had no idea where I was. I had done it again. First thing I did was get in her purse to find out what her name was. And I started to wander around the room, and it wasn't a room, it was actually a condo. And I started to walk out the bedroom and through the kitchen and the dining room, and I see the sliding glass doors. And I open up the sliding glass doors, and I walk out onto the balcony, and there's this beautiful, beautiful aquamarine blue water, and there's palm trees blowing in the breeze, and a beautiful sand beach, and a swimming pool, and a tiki bar. I'm not in Vermont. So, I mean, I remember from the days previously of when I would wake up someplace and have to figure out where the hell I was. I went outside, I went downstairs, I went down to the front desk. Instead of making a stupid ass of myself and saying, excuse me, where am I? I looked around and there's, you know, the racks of tourist magazines like we've got in our hotels. And I picked up one of them and it says, welcome to St. Thomas Virgin Islands. So I go back upstairs, I take inventory of what I've got. I have a briefcase, I have a toothbrush, I have a pair of shorts, I have a t-shirt, I have a pair of flip-flops, I have one business check, and I have $10,000. And I have absolutely no idea how I got there, who this girl is, except I've figured out what her name is by looking at her driver's license. And I don't remember names, but I remember her name, because I had to make amends to her. A couple of weeks later, that $10,000 was gone. Oh, by the way, I forget to tell you, I bought one-way tickets. And so when the money was gone, there was no way to get home. So I called the bank, and I said to the banker, I said, I need you to wire me some money. And she goes, Andy, I'd love to wire you some money, but your wife came and cleaned out the account. Oh, boy. So I had to... humble myself. It wasn't humbling. And humility is one of the things that I've really had to focus on throughout my sobriety. I had to pick up the phone and I had to call her. Because I'm stuck down in there in St. Thomas. And I had to convince her to get me home. Because I'm a mess. I have been drinking round the clock for 3 weeks, including the time that I'd still been back in the States. And I had to figure out how somehow to get this girl home. And because she said, yeah, I'll bring you home, but the bitch stays. Ended up getting a ticket. Ended up conning my way into them taking a business check from me at the airport for her ticket without any identification. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have a wallet with me. I didn't have anything. Got home, and I went back into treatment again because that was the condition that I came home was, is that you're going back into treatment. And I spent 14 days in the psych ward with crazy people who really were crazy, waiting for the spot in treatment to open up. And I bounced back and forth throughout that 14-day period of whether I was going to treatment or not. And when I got to treatment, I bounced back and forth through the first week of whether I was going to stay or not. And all of a sudden, I'm not sure why, but somehow my eyes begin to open and my soul began to open and my heart began to open to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and that there was a chance at recovery for me. And I'm going to pick up the pace here because there's something important that was mentioned at the podium earlier about relapse. I came out of treatment. I got involved in AA. I got a sponsor. I did the steps. I sponsored others. I got involved in service work. I became the AA guy. I worked for an AA. I was surrounded with AAs. We used to take road trips to other states to go to AA meetings. I used to say to my sponsor, why are we driving this far to go to an AA meeting? Well, you used to drive over here to drink, didn't you? So, you know, one thing led to another, and I built another successful business, and things were going well. I was on to wife number three by this time. There's a continuing pattern of using things outside of me to try and change the way things are going on the inside. If it looks good, tastes good, feels good, can make me look good, taste good, or feel good, I will use it to try and change what's inside of me. The economy took a tank in 1987. They changed the tox laws. You guys probably weren't even born yet. And I ended up losing my business. And I ended up getting offered a job in Springfield, Missouri. Geographical cure again. Even though I'm in sobriety, I'm using character defects and old patterns to try and change things that have to do with my situation. And instead of staying put and trying to fix that situation, I took an opportunity and left. Divorce number three. When I got there, I got so involved with work and trying to rebuild my financial stability and buy another house and do all this other stuff, I didn't get reconnected with meetings. I didn't get a new sponsor. I didn't call my old sponsor. I didn't get involved in service work. I didn't continue to do the steps. And I whipped out that cheap Walmart trash bag and I put it right over the top of my shoulder. It only took about a year for that trash bag to get filled up. Now, one thing that I had done is that I had told everybody around me that I was an alcoholic and I could not safely drink. People that I worked with, friends, different things like that. But I definitely wasn't working a program and I was definitely not moving away from a drink, but I was moving back towards a drink. But the one thing that happened in my mind is that I was so afraid of a drink. I was so scared of it. I didn't want to end up sleeping under a bridge again. Skipped over that part, but that happened too. I didn't want to be homeless. I didn't want to be hitchhiking around the country. I didn't want to end up in jail again, sleeping in my own puke. I think we've all been there. So I convinced myself and everybody around me that marijuana was not my drug of choice and that it would be okay if I happened to do a little marijuana maintenance and smoke some pot. You know, and it didn't do the things around, you know, in my outside life that alcohol had done to me. I didn't end up in jail. I didn't go into blackouts and wake up in another country. I didn't, you know, that type of stuff didn't happen. But I got spiritually sick really fast. And, you know, and there had been times that I had toyed with the idea of suicide back previously during my life and my drinking, but this time it got real serious because I got so spiritually sick that I didn't know which way to turn. Because I didn't feel like I could walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and tell anybody what was going on. I didn't feel like I could tell anybody that I worked with what was going on with me spiritually. I couldn't tell my girlfriend what was going on spiritually with me because I'd convinced everybody that I was okay with this marijuana thing. Well, it very quickly became apparent that it was starting to destroy me, and it was strongly suggested that I get back into treatment again. And I ended up in treatment, and I walked in there, and they were going to put me in detox. And one of the counselors came out and said, "You don't put anybody in detox for marijuana. He needs a meeting." And instead of going in through the, you know, usual indoctrination of doing the Hazeltine forms and all the different stuff that you do in treatment, my counselor sat down, and we broke out the big book, and we started doing the steps. And I started going to meetings. Usually they wouldn't let you go to an outside meeting for 2 weeks when you're in treatment. The first night I was there, I was in an outside meeting. And it happened to be August 7th, 1994. The first day that I had picked up a white chip in my run of sobriety before I decided to do marijuana maintenance had been August 7th, 1985. So that's what, 8 years later? I'm going to pick up an 8-year medallion. No, I'm not. But I'm thinking I am. And my counselor is sitting in the same meeting, and she's, you know, they go through the white chips, kind of like here. And they're starting to do years and multiples of years, and I'm getting ready to stand up, and she grabs me by the short hair on the back of my neck and pulls me back into the pew. And she goes, "They're going to come around for a second chance for a white chip, and you better get your ass up there." Again, I have been thoroughly humiliated. Ego deflation is a theme of my life. But every time I have had my ego deflated, it has been self-inflicted. I cannot blame it on toxic parents. I cannot blame it on anyone else. I cannot blame it on any one of my four wives. I cannot blame it on anybody but me and my behavior. You know, I came out of that treatment program and I got connected back into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did the right thing. You know, I got involved in the steps again. I got a sponsor. I went to meetings. I was working with others. And I've moved a couple of times since then. I've also gotten married and divorced again since then. And hopefully I have recovered from that malady as well. And the one thing that is completely forefront in my life today, that it doesn't make any difference what my outside may look like, nor does it look like what I think your outside looks like. The only way that I can completely and totally continue to recover is that if I work the steps, I work with others, I stay connected to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sponsor, I'm willing to sponsor others, I stay connected with that sponsor. You know, I used to look at guys that had 15, 16, 20 years of sobriety, and they'd say, "Yeah, I got a sponsor." And I go, "What do you need a sponsor for?" "I need a sponsor." And I try and have lunch with that sponsor once a week. We sit down and connect, and he's been sick lately, so we haven't been able to connect as much. So I've got a backup sponsor that I connect with. I make sure that I show up and be accountable for my home group. I don't think about a drink today. I don't think about the things that I try or can try to pick up from the outside to change my life. I try and really try and stay God-centered and outside of my own universe and in somebody else's universe. Whether I'm dealing with people in the program or I'm dealing with people in my home life or I'm dealing with at work, especially at work. Because I had a sponsor tell me one time, and it used to really tick me off, "If you're angry, you're wrong." What? Are you kidding me? You mean what that SOB did to me? I can't be pissed off about that? No. What was your part in it? What do you mean, what was my part in it? I didn't do anything. It's him. No, what was your part in it? Even if it's that I set my expectations too high and he did not fulfill my expectations of the situation that I'm actually working under, it's my fault. Nobody can create anything in me that I don't allow. You know, I never thought when I first got sober that I would, you know, stand up here being an old timer, I guess, close. It used to be 10 years. When I first got sober, 10 years was an old timer. Now it's 20. So I don't know that I'm ever going to get there because I keep moving the bar. But the one thing that I remember is that sometimes the days are very, very long. Sometimes the minutes are very, very long. But the years are really short. Time goes by really fast. You know, and there's other times when I'm having struggles in my life, I've learned also to be very careful about what I pray for. I prayed for patience one time. You don't get anything unless you work for it. I learned that for patience, I have to practice it. For humility, I have to be humble. For strength, I have to work out. There are times now that I just pray for peace. God, let me breathe. And then when I wake up tomorrow, you can tell me what I'm supposed to do next. It used to be that when I put my head on the shoulder or on the pillow at night when I was drinking, it was like the gavel went down and the committee came to order and the voices in my head started talking. One of the biggest gifts I've been given in sobriety, if I don't drink too much caffeine too late in the day, is that when I put my head on the pillow at night, I go to sleep, which is really cool. And I'm going to finish up with a shameless plug, as it was not announced. Coming up on this Saturday night will be the pancake dinner, also known as the spaghetti breakfast. And this will be to raise money for the Suncoast Roundup, of which I'm a part of that committee. And if you would like to attend this, it starts, doors open at 5 o'clock, dinner's at 5:30. We're going to have pancakes, sausage, juice, fruit, coffee, all the other stuff that you would normally have with breakfast. So if you get up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you can make it for breakfast. And it's going to be where we hold Monday night speakers meeting. Our speaker's going to be Sweet Georgia Jim. There's going to be a special guest speaker from this room speaking as well, yet to be announced. And with that, I want to thank you for my sobriety and allowing me to be of service.
My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. This is Dr. Bob's last message delivered at the first International Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio in 1950. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with this feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that flash into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let us also remember God, that erring member of the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing, none of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous kind, little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency that we are not willing to extend or attempt to, that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.